this abatement cost curve has become pretty much popular, not only in the private sector, but also in the public sector as well these days. So there has been many criticisms in terms of the level of the accuracy of their analysis, but you know, somehow it can be a good reference. So basically, what I would like you to focus on now is that in order to meet the target that the IPCC has recommended by 2020, global world needs to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 19 gigatons. 14 out of 19 gigatons needs to be reduced by developing countries, whereas only 5 gigatons need to be reduced by developed countries. So this is a striking phenomenon. We used to think that, oh, okay, probably developed world needs to bear more responsibilities, but the fact that we are facing now tell us that, oh, no, I mean, the system that we used to rely on needs to be changed because more emission reduction needs to be done by developing countries. When I'm talking about developing countries at this time, I'm not talking about 150 or more. I only talk about the 10 or less. I can list them all now in front of you, including China, India, Brazil, Mexico, Korea, Indonesia, South Africa. Then we can cover pretty much everything. So there is an interesting thing here, issue. So when you talk about developing countries, we used to talk about the majority of the countries in the world, in politics, in culture, in economics, in every field. But in terms of climate change, especially mitigation, in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, we only need small number of developing countries. They represent most of those 14 gigatons. Many developing countries don't emit greenhouse gases that much. But they are vulnerable to the risks of the greenhouse gases, right? So that's why there is another issue of adaptation. When you try to deal with the climate change issues, the first most important thing is mitigation, right? Once we reduce greenhouse gas emissions, then we can solve the problem. But current framework that we have at the global level doesn't allow us to implement that ideal stage right away because of the fragmented nature of global politics, constrained by sovereignty or national interest and whatever. So it's a one single problem, climate change, but we have to deal with about 200 different national interests. Then it's not centralized. UNFCCC cannot order countries to implement them, and United States was not happy about it. So that's why United States, legitimately, legally speaking, legitimately withdrew from Kyoto Protocol. U.S. had good reasons from the national interest point of view. Japan is saying that they are not be able to implement the obligations under UNFCCC in the second period of commitment under the Kyoto Protocol if we can amend it, because you know Japan cannot do anything more. That's a legitimate argument considering their national interest. In this sense, China, for example, has become now world's largest emitter in the world, is still saying that we are developing countries. So under the Kyoto Protocol, I'm sure you know this, every developing country doesn't have any single legally binding obligations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions at all. So China is still arguing that we are developing countries under the UNFCCC's umbrella based on common but differential responsibility, so we don't want to do anything. We are leading the developing countries group. Same with, honestly speaking, Korea as well. But here, as someone who's concerned about climate change, well, I mean, that's something that that doesn't exactly what we want to talk about from global point of view. So therefore, again, it is necessary for us to guarantee these advanced developing countries to meet their national interest. Otherwise, they cannot persuade their domestic constituents. They have to report things to the Congress, to the government. So we have to find it out. And that's about, okay, you invest in these list of the technologies. Then it will guarantee you develop your economy. As a result, all these are we call green or clean, so that we can reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Of course, there are many ways to do so. This is not the right place for me to talk about it, but at least now we understand Asia is important, and the roles of the advanced developing countries are important. So if you address these two, then you can contribute to the world a lot on dealing with not only climate change, also leading global new economic architecture. Again, why Asia? In terms of financial flows, most of the money needs to be invested in Asia, including Middle East, India, rest of Asia, and China. Then I don't have to explain about this more. So Asia is very, very important. Not because Korea is located in Asia. It's lucky for Korea to be located in Asia, but Asia is very, very important. Here, even if I'm going to talk about it later, then to the colleagues of my United States, then how would you identify yourself to this discussion? As an outsider, or as an insider, or as an intermediary, that's the question for the United States. So now, I'm talking only about Asia. But if you look at Asia, actually, there are different focuses. If I go to South Asia, it's surprising. Many policymakers have less interest in climate change issues, and of course, with the green growth issues as well. And because, as I said, most of them are not big emitters. And then so there are some issues. So I say when you talk about the South Asia, you have to focus on adaptation. And if you go up to Northeast Asia, story looks very different. China, Japan, and Korea are all big emitters. So we represent pretty much amount of the total emission of the world. So focus of Northeast Asia needs to be given to deal with issues on mitigation. So there are two different focuses. Many people seem to not to understand, not to give or pay attention to these differences. But when you talk about Asia, actually there are two different dynamics that you have to understand. And now I put the Australia and New Zealand, and I didn't say anything, because now we start to think, how is the role of Australia and New Zealand? So that's the issue. And then coming back to Korea, then Dr. Yang talked about the East Asia Climate Partnership. I say it's a package of ODA, tries to assist in developing countries mostly on adaptation issues, even if it has some components of mitigation. So that's the nature of the East Asia Climate Partnership that I read. Then what about the Korea's cooperation with the major greenhouse gas emitters in the Asia Pacific? Through several routes, but mainly Korea is trying to utilize Global Green Growth Institute. I'm wearing the necktie of the Global Green Growth Institute today to show you how important it is to Korea, whereas Dr. Yang used a different type of the green necktie, which represent to the President Committee on Green Growth. I should have to wear that as well, but I choose this because to emphasize the important role of the Global Green Growth Institute, even in the context of Asia. But still, many of the cooperation by the Korea are government-focused ones. So we heard about the important role of private sector, but I'm implying that from my analysis, that there is a less involvement of the private sector into the formation of the policies that, of course, needs to be primarily dealt with by the government, public sector, but it is important for private sector to be more involved. And there is the issue of the reluctance of China in participating in the cooperation activities. So that's something about it. With the international organization, there are several. Then I put a question mark with the World Bank. I don't see the World Bank has been involved as much as I wish. So there is an issue that maybe global financial institutions needs to be involved a little more. So challenges ahead. Korea, we have been talking about great things about China, about Korea today. But of course, there are some challenges that we have to deal with. First of all, we need to develop a better strategic guideline toward its role in the Asia-Pacific region. So many things are based on the detail sectors, and we put everything in the same basket. But I'm hoping that we can have a better strategic guideline so that we can implement all these details from having more macro perspective. And need to develop the closer cooperation with the financial institutions, because we need the money to implement the green growth. It's about investing money in developing new technologies. It's a matter of how to promote the markets. Initially, we need to inject some money. So my previous speaker was talking about how to promote the smart green cities. Then, of course, it doesn't come up pretty much well from the micro perspective. But if you read Change the Global Governance, then there is a necessary for us to invest certain our resources to selected areas so that we can promote, we can provide more spillover effects to other issues. And then, as I said, we need to more develop the policies based on public-private partnership. The understanding on the PPP in Korea seems to be a little bit different from that of United States, for example. I know President Obama spent almost half of his time when he gave an address in the General Assembly meeting of the United Nations last year. He spared almost half of his time to explain about the importance of the PPP concept. Then my question is that to an extent that my Korean colleagues might share what President Obama was talking about on that day. So we are talking about PPP, but it seems like we are talking about different types of PPP. Okay, my last slide is about, therefore, I would argue there are many opportunities for bilateral cooperation between Korea and the United States. So before President Lee actually announced his vision on green growth, I was writing the series of newspaper columns with Jungang Daily in that year. One of my column titles was, "It's time for us to think about climate change alliance between Korea and the United States." Then after that, somehow, President Lee announced his green growth policy. And still now, I think I was right. You know, we have been talking about strategic alliance in dealing with security issues. I'm saying that security issues are still important, but the span that we have to think about in terms of the creating reason and global governance, then we need to incorporate non-traditional issues as well, which would become very core component of the national interest for both countries. In this sense, I'm pretty sure that this area might be the right area for both countries to work together. And therefore, strategic bilateral dialogue between two governments needs to be launched. And I was just told that the State Department of the United States seems to launch a small desk to deal with the green growth issues. So I welcome that approach, and I hope that that approach can be continued by the more strengthened bilateral strategic dialogue between the countries. Political considerations on forming regional order needs to be maintained. Pretty much everything on green growth policy has been discussed by economists or engineers. But I'm saying that it's also time for us to add one more component where we can talk about things from the strategic point of view. So I think it will help both countries to continue our helpful relationship between two countries. And then I'm thinking about what are the appropriate venues, and there are several. Then we can utilize all those existing ones, or possibly we can think about the newly creating things. Here, I leave my questions to my U.S. colleagues that would you want to be outside of the green growth dialogue, or would you be a core partner of the green growth? Then question is that it should be developed in the context of Asia and Pacific. So that's the last statement of mine. Thank you very much. Oh, by the way, I published one book, and this is more important that this is the report that we have organized for the first time in the Asia-Pacific region to deal with the security implications of climate change. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Chung. Our last speaker is Trevor Hauser, who is with the Rhodium Group and is a visiting fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and also the Colin Powell Center for Policy Studies. He's a very active writer and commentator on energy markets, climate change, and the roles that emerging Asian countries play in both. He's been very active, especially on China, U.S.-China engagement on clean energy and climate change. And I think that is particularly interesting and relevant because we've had some discussion of Korea's interest in renewable energy, but the media really focuses a lot on what China does these days, and so particularly interested in hearing your presentation.
Thanks, Scott, and it's a pleasure to join you all here today. Very uncharacteristically for me, I don't have a PowerPoint, but probably fortunate for you all, as I am the only thing standing between you and lunch. And so I will try to keep my comments mercifully brief so we can have a little bit of Q&A. And that'll be relatively easy because I'm mostly going to second many of the points that that Dr. Chung made in his presentation. It's appropriate that this panel is in discussing global green growth is talking about green growth in the Asian context, because that is where the green growth story is going to be. The U.S. will have growth. Jury's still out on whether that growth is going to be green. Europe's going to have green. Jury's out on whether there's going to be any growth. So the only place you get both is going to be Asia. And that's good news, because without the green of the Asian growth, the International Energy Agency projects that Asia will account for just north of 90% of global growth in CO2 emissions over the next decade. And it's not just a climate change imperative. Asia is much more dependent on foreign sources of energy than other parts of the region. And indeed, if that growth doesn't turn green, it's unlikely that emerging Asian countries will be able to achieve their long-term growth objectives, not necessarily just because of climate constraints, but because of actual resource availability and price constraints. Now, within those very large numbers, as other speakers have mentioned, South Korea's direct impact is relatively modest, certainly when compared to China. But I think that South Korea can punch far above its weight in this area in three ways. So the first, and this echoes points that Dr. Chung made, is as a model. South Korea as a in the transition period between developing and developed country can demonstrate in important ways how a emerging economy can both achieve its economic growth objectives and its environmental objectives. And neighbors in the region will be watching very closely Korea's success or failure in that regard in the years ahead, not least China, as it looks specifically to other models for increasing the economy beyond the $3,000-$5,000 per capita income that the existing Chinese growth model has been very successful in delivering. It's difficult for China to look to Japan, which is so different and so far down the road and where there's so much historical baggage, but Korea can demonstrate some very pragmatic economic growth strategies that that can be broadly applicable in China and serve as a good economic model. Second, Korea can play a very important role as a broker in international cooperation, again, echoing some of the remarks that Dr. Chung made. I had the misfortune of serving as a U.S. climate change negotiator for the year up through the Copenhagen talks, and one of my few pleasures in that job was getting to work with the Korean delegation that played a very important role in bridging developing developed country divides. Korea is a member of the OECD and in that respect considered a developed country, but is still a non-Annex I member to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, and in that world is considered a developing country. And some very adept Korean diplomats have been extremely critical in delivering what meager progress we've been able to eke out of those negotiations over the past few years. But I think potentially more importantly, Korea can play a pivotal role in the kind of pragmatic technology-based collaboration between large emitters that we've seen arise in recent years, first through the Asia-Pacific Partnership, through APEC, through the Major Economies Forum, and now through the Clean Energy Ministerial and ISCAN. Korea is playing a very dominant role and a very useful role in diplomatic engagement. Finally, I think that Korea can play an important role as a defender of the green growth model against some of the risks that it's going to face going forward. The economic narrative, the overall narrative surrounding climate change has shifted in recent years. So if we go back 3-4 years, the approach internationally was there's a problem, a scientific problem, that's climate change. The solution is reducing emissions. Let's figure out how much those emissions need to get reduced. Let's allocate that burden between countries. Let's get together in negotiations and figure out how to allocate that burden. And then individual countries will go and figure out how to meet that target that they've agreed to internationally. That model's not working out terribly well for all the national interest reasons that Dr. Chung mentioned. So what we see is more bottom-up push, where countries for myriad domestic reasons, energy security, economic growth, environmental protection, are implementing emission reduction policies in different ways and at different speeds, and collaborating on a technical basis to find out how to push those policies farther and make them more effective. In many countries, Korea not least, a significant motive is the prospect of becoming a market leader in emerging technologies and being able to export those technologies around the world. That comes with risks. When we were looking simply at how do we reduce emissions for the lowest cost, then whatever country could produce the equipment at the lowest cost was going to be the winner, and it made sense for us to all buy equipment from the country that could produce it at the lowest cost because that would reduce emissions at the lowest cost. And the impact on U.S. electricity prices or Chinese electricity prices or Korean electricity prices would be lowest. If instead you're selling your policies to domestic constituents based on the premise that they will help grow your economy, make your industries competitive internationally, and capture export markets, there are risks that trade policy changes will come along with that, that threaten the ability of the global community to move to on a low-carbon pathway in a cost-effective manner. So let me give some concrete examples. We have a very large stimulus package passed in the U.S. in 2009. Part of getting that stimulus package through Congress was including a Buy America provision that ensured that that content paid for with stimulus dollars went either to American firms or countries who'd signed the GPA agreement under the WTO so that we were consistent with our WTO commitments. We've seen local content requirements surrounding green tech arise in China, in India, in Canada, in Brazil, all around the world as countries try to make sure that the policy support that they're providing to these industries, which often comes in the form of tax subsidies, that policy support, the benefit of which accrues to domestic companies. Now, the downside of that, the upside is that it's the kind of grease that lubes the political wheels and helps get policy passed. The downside is if you have every country trying to be the leading global manufacturer in solar panels or in wind turbines, is that the cost of that technology is going to be prohibitively expensive for adoption around the world, and our ability to achieve our emission reduction objectives globally is going to be reduced. In Asia in particular, open markets, free trade, has been critical both in linking the region together politically and driving national economies. Korea in particular has been very successful in demonstrating its ability to benefit not only as a contributor to global supply chains, but as a consumer from global supply chains. So Korean firms innovating domestically, sourcing manufacturing from China, exporting to the West is a pretty well-established model in other industries. I think Korea's ability in the green tech space to demonstrate that it can grow its economy through doing what part of the value chain Korea does best, while leaving other parts of the value chain that Korea maybe doesn't do best to China or Japan or other countries, and that type of approach, which has worked pretty well for us in international trade more broadly, can also work in clean tech, can be pivotal in ensuring that protectionist tendencies don't derail a green growth movement before it gets started. So those are my kind of high-level comments, and want to make sure we have some time for Q&A before we break for lunch. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Trevor. Okay. Now we're going to extend this to about 12:15, and we'll still have time for lunch. So we have plenty of time for discussion. And I think that we've had two very interesting presentations. I don't know if there's anybody who would like to start us off with a question right over here.
Thank you. This is Xin'an Qi from Georgetown University. I'd like to hear from more from Professor Chang about Koreans' role in narrowing down the gap between developed and developing countries in climate change negotiations. So if you look at a map, it's very interesting to see that Korea is surrounded by standing between two country blocks. Generally, on one hand, you have China, one of the basic countries that refused to, reluctant to cut its greenhouse gas emissions. On the other hand, you have Japan, Russia, and Korea's strategic ally, the U.S., which are reluctant to play within the Kyoto framework. So my question is, what specifically would Korea do to narrow down the gap between developed and developing countries in order to secure second commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol, since Korea is applying for hosting COP18 in 2012, and that would be the last chance last year to negotiate that. So you have any comments on that? Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much for the question. Yes, I have some answers to that question. As I said, that if we go to, I was participating in the negotiations as a part of Korean delegation from time to time, and then I'm aware not only Korea, but also with every country who has been participating in the negotiation has been the concentrated by original framework that has been imposed in 1992 when UNFCCC was created. That's division of the countries between Annex 1 and non-Annex 1 countries. It's extremely difficult, I would say, politically, to change the mix of this formula. So we have to work based on this formula even to continue our efforts beyond the 2012. In the sense, like Korea, what we have done, I think we have done two things. First, more technically, as Dr. Yang introduced, the Korea proposed the NAMA registry concept, which was an easier one. So basically, the concept was that list of the domestically appropriate mitigation actions that your countries are doing, you just list them all, and there is no obligation based on that. So in the sense that developing countries' world was somewhat appeased by this concept, by showing to the Annex 1 countries that the developing countries are doing something. We are not doing anything, but we are doing something by listing their actions on the list. But it's an easier one. So everybody can list something. There is not that much a monitoring system imposed in that. So that's something that Korea could propose for the negotiation. Second, more importantly, that's what we have been discussing all this morning, introducing concept of green growth. In other words, many people are, thinking that formulating international framework is similar to that of domestic one, but actually that's not. International community is pretty much decentralized. We don't have the government, we don't have the legislative body, we don't have the judicial body at the international level. We have to work based on this. So I said national interest has placed a lot of barriers on for us moving forward in achieving the global targets together. So in that sense, we have to find out letting the governments to meet their own national interests. Then as a result, then we can add all those achievements into a certain fashion so that we can legitimize all those actions within the framework, I hope the UNFCCC or similar one, so that we can move forward. So in the sense that in terms of dealing with legally binding obligations, Korea proposed the NAMA registry concept, which was an easy one for everybody can do, but we are not sure to what extent that we can bring up the effective result out of it, but that's the something. More importantly, implementing green growth policy, not only at the domestic level, but also hopefully at the international level, will hugely contribute to addressing the targets that we are hoping to achieve within the UNFCCC regime. So as a person, I'm hoping that the GGGI, once it would be transformed into the organization based on treaty, one day we will have a chance to let it link to UNFCCC regime. For example, IPCC is playing a scientific role to support activities within the UNFCCC. What we don't have now, we don't have any organization which can provide answers how to implement the policies. So I hope that GGGI can be transformed into a treaty-based organization which could closely work with the UNFCCC. That's why I was hoping that Korea can host COP meeting next year. Then I do hope that government people really do understand the importance of line of these discussions. So I hope that can be an answer to you. Thank you.
Okay. We'll go back here and then up front.
Thank you so much for your presentations. My name is Rachel Yoka. I'm with a company called Timothy Haas & Associates out of Philadelphia. We talked a little bit about how many of these initiatives have been driven or spurred by economists and engineers and technology. And it strikes me that one of the elements that may be being covered in another area of policy, especially in Korea, is the connection between land use and housing. I've heard a lot about single-use vehicles, electric vehicles. I haven't heard a lot today about reducing the need for a single occupancy vehicle, period, which is a very common smart growth strategy. So in the United States, HUD is working with the Department of Energy to link transportation and land use more closely, hoping that we could walk, bike, mass transit. What's being done in Korea? Is the MLTM doing any of that? Is that being covered elsewhere but not within the green growth framework?
Okay. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I might ask Dr. Chung to answer that, but then also Dr. Young may have a comment on that as well.
Right. I think I would take it as a comment, right, rather than as a question. So. In addition to what you just mentioned, of course, there are several areas that have been not yet included in the Korean Green Growth Policy basket, but I am hoping that we can further elaborate our efforts so that we can have a comprehensive, formula where we can deal with every sector that is necessary for us to implement. Okay, thank you.
Dr. Young. Need a mic up here. Front.
I know that Mr. Hauser is an expert on the UNFCCC negotiation. I appreciated reading your paper assessing the outcome of Copenhagen. And I would like to redirect the question that has just been raised at you. And let me phrase the question in this way. Two questions, actually. Do you think that this idea of green growth can impact the narrative that's employed in the context of the UNFCCC negotiation? And secondly, suppose, this is a hypothesis, suppose that Korea wins the bid to host the COP18 next year. As the host of COP18, do you think that Korean government can bring difference to the terms of negotiations and bring a different outcome than otherwise to the UNFCCC negotiation?
Great question, challenging question. I think certainly, Korea has already changed the terms of the negotiations through the NAMA's recommendation, which was basically the foundation stone that a more bottom-up, pragmatic approach to international climate diplomacy was built upon. So instead of a kind of binary divide between developed countries take legally mandated actions and developing countries receive money, The NAMA's approach allowed countries who were in a position, developing countries who were in a position to take more ambitious action, to do so and have that adequately reflected, but not compromise some of the core legal issues that developing countries are still not willing to move on. It was unclear after Copenhagen whether or not that approach would stick, in large part because of the Danish chair was seen as illegitimate by a number of process issues, primarily. And it's such a paradigm shift in the way international climate diplomacy works that it took countries a while to come up to speed with. That approach was endorsed by all countries save one in Cancun. And so I think that bottom-up approach, which Korea was instrumental in building, pragmatic countries pushing each other to go farther, slowly building confidence that this type of action is possible, a green growth narrative being a very strong driver of that, I think is here to stay. Korea hosting the COP would be very useful in helping to accelerate that narrative even farther. The one risk is the question that was raised before. We still have this legal treaty that doesn't have an expiration date called the Kyoto Protocol that's supposed to be renewed, that's hanging out there. And countries are very emotional about the Kyoto Protocol. And managing the Kyoto Protocol's transformation into something that looks more like this bottom-up approach is going to be very challenging. I think at the end of the day, it's going to rest, like many things in the negotiations, on the skill of a few lawyers in drafting language that is able to meet everyone's respective concerns. If you're Japan, your problem is that, and to a lesser extent Europe, it's very difficult for you to sell a treaty at home where you have legally binding commitments, but China does not, and the U.S. does not. Neither the U.S. or China are in a position to take legally binding commitments for different reasons. Both China and the U.S. have listed their national pledges in registries in different ways, because one's developed, one's developing, and that the trick will be finding language that describes the Kyoto Protocol Party Annex I members' commitments in slightly more legally binding ways than it describes the registry pledges from developing countries and from the U.S. in a way that satisfies European and Japanese concerns, but doesn't look to the developing world like you've just killed the Kyoto Protocol. There are only a few people in the world that have the skill to pull something like that off. A couple of them happen to be Korean, I am hopeful, though not terribly optimistic, maybe that'll be able to happen. It's a very big risk. The international community was largely able to punt on that question in Cancun, and it's going to come to a head in South Africa, and after that, where the next COP is held.
Give me the names of those two Koreans.
Any other questions? Got one in the back here.
Thank you for your presentation. I'm a student in Korea, Handong University, and I'm doing internship at Organization of America. The big technological gap between developing countries and developed countries, probably advanced technology to reduce CO2 emissions are too advanced to be applied to those developing countries. So I want to ask to Dr. Chang, do you think that if a Korean government need to do something, need to support institutional reformation to develop an appropriate technology so that, the advanced technology can be reformed to be applied to those developing countries, developed countries, and that's my question.
I'm not sure I catched your question correctly. So you were talking about the technology transfer then, in general.
Yes,
is that
that's
correct?
Right. Yes, that's right.
Well, I mean, there are two different sides of technology transfer. One is the legitimate reasons why we have to talk about. Then at the same time, we have to consider the realist, you know, the reality that we are facing. So technology has been one of the core elements that we have to deal with in the context of green growth and then climate change. Then it is necessary for us to have developing countries equipped with better technologies. But the question is that most of the advanced technologies that we are talking about and we will talk about are possessed by the industries. And then they are not looking at sharing the burdens. So they are primarily looking at profit generating. So that's the reality that we are facing. So here, in general, what I can say now is that utilize the ODA policy to a certain extent. And then I don't have any concrete reasons how to deal with, for example, IP intellectual property issues. Unless we address this issue, then we cannot go to the details. That's why inside the UN, even if we have been talking about technology transfer a lot, but we have generated little, actually, tangible results. So we are keeping working on it. And we are hoping to find out some good solutions. That's why I think, as Dr. Yang mentioned, that Korea is proposing to set up a center to deal with the technology issues. So that's where we are, and we will move forward. Okay, thank you.
Let me maybe add a couple points on that. Not all mitigation technologies are sophisticated. Some are extremely basic. The U.S. Energy Secretary, Secretary Chu, loves to talk about the tremendous impact painting roofs white can have on reducing energy demand in buildings and reflecting light back up to the stratosphere, which reduces temperature increases on Earth. White paint is readily available to all countries. There are no IP restrictions on the purchase of white paint. I'd be happy to send anybody a couple buckets if that's what they'd like. And, I mean, this is a problem in the U.S. as well as other places. I mean, we have a technology fetishism when it comes to climate change. We all want to see the kind of snazzy breakthrough technology that comes out of a lab that's going to transform the world. We expect to see things in the energy space like we've seen in information technology, where you have disruptive innovations that completely change markets in a few years, and where IP is very central to the ability to spread those technologies. You cannot find two industries more different from each other than information technology and the energy industry, with the exception of smart grid and a couple other applications. Energy technologies are, if you look at the cost of a nuclear power plant or a natural gas combined cycle power plant or a solar farm, the amount of that project cost that's actually a kind of IP-controlled technology is extraordinarily small. Most of it is engineering cost and construction cost and steel cost. So now the good news is there's actually a lot that policy cooperation can do to drive down those costs by standardizing product codes and specifications, by sharing best practices on policy enablement, by sharing EPC design software. And that's the sort of thing that groups like the Clean Energy Ministerial are focused on, finding ways that policy collaboration and technology collaboration can significantly drive down costs in ways that don't, not only do they not compromise private sector intellectual property, but they actually benefit the private sector in both developed and developing countries alike. Now, the final point I'd make on that is if you look at where most clean energy mitigation technology is installed in the past 2 years, it is in developing countries and largely made by developing countries. So the kind of narrative surrounding technology transfer is in many ways a couple years behind the reality of the rate of clean energy deployment in the world.
Okay. We can take one more question or we can break for lunch and move to our luncheon speaker. Okay, we have last question.
One country that hasn't been mentioned is North Korea. Does it have any role to play in all this?
No.
The environments of the two countries, you know, they sort of interact in some ways, I guess.
Well, North Korea, I think I would put North Korea in a context of the building the partnership with the global world by themselves, so that at least that they can show their willingness to participate in sharing the burdens. At the same time,